Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The story of African explorer David Livingstone is one fraught with ambivalence today in contemporary Africa. On one hand, his efforts and accounts of the East African slave trade led to its demise. But on the other hand, his explorations directly led to another source of exploitation, colonialism. But for Zimbabwean writer Patina Gappa, there's another story that's captured her imagination for nearly 20 years. Shortly after Henry Stanley met Livingstone with the eponymous line, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume," Livingstone died. Yet his African attendants did something very unusual. They carried his body, against all taboos of the time, nearly 1,000 miles back to the coast of Zanzibar so that his body could be returned to Britain. In her novel, Out of Darkness, Shining Light, Gappa imagines the forces that compelled Livingstone's party to make this decision and this arduous and unusual journey. She tells her fictional story through two actual members named in Livingstone's journals, Halima, a cook with an outrageous tongue, according to the writings, and Jacob Wainwright, a freed slave of East African Yao descent who had learned to read and write, who brought Livingstone's body and his journals to Europe, the documents which would pave the way for colonialism in southern Africa. Patina Gappa is the author of An Elegy for Easterly, The Book of Memory, and Rotten Row. Her work has been shortlisted for the Orwell Prize, the Los Angeles Times Book Award, and the PEN America Open Book Award. Her latest novel is titled Out of Darkness, Shining Light. It's published by Scribner. Patina Gappa, thanks very much for your time. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Rich, for inviting me.
From your acknowledgments in the book, it appears that this book was just about as large an obsession for you as finding the source of the Nile was for David Livingstone. So what fueled this obsession?
It was really the story about his companions, because I first read the Livingstone story when I was a child, about 10 or 11 years old. And at the end of my Lady Bird book about David Livingstone was this extraordinary sentence: his faithful companions carried his body for 9 months so that he could be buried at Westminster Abbey. And then when I was 16 and we actually did the Journeys of Livingstone in history, again, that sentence, you know, his faithful companions carried his body for 9 months. And I always wondered, why on earth did they do such an extraordinary thing?
Yes. And, you know, actually, I did a little bit of research on my own, and it's pretty hard to find anything more than that sentence anytime you're looking at the life of David Livingstone. It's literally, and his followers carried him 1,000 miles to Zanzibar so he could get on, they could put him on a ship and send him back to England. And but that's about it.
Precisely. And it was precisely that silence that I wanted to answer. You know, I wanted to write about that journey, his last, his final journey on African soil, but I wanted to write it from the perspective of those companions who are never written about.
So before we talk about the novel, I have to tell you, my guess is most Americans know nothing of David Livingstone. If it was 20 or 30 years ago, I'd say, well, people will know about Henry Stanley's famous quote, "Dr. Livingstone," I presume. But I don't think even they would know that. That's fallen away out of popular use. So why is he important? And more importantly, to a contemporary Zimbabwean writer, why is he important?
Well, it's not possible to understand the history of my country, Zimbabwe, or the neighboring countries like Malawi, Angola, Mozambique, Zambia, Botswana, Namibia even. It's not possible to understand the modern history of African nations without understanding the effect that David Livingstone's travels had on the scramble for Africa and the decision that was made in Berlin in 1884 to carve up the whole continent. So David Livingstone was a precursor to colonialism. He wasn't himself a colonialist, but his journeys opened up the continent to exploitation by European powers. So to us studying in Zimbabwe, we know who David Livingstone was. We have a David Livingstone school, the city of Victoria Falls, where he found these famous falls and named them after Queen Victoria. It's still called Queen Victoria. It's still called Victoria Falls. So we cannot understand our history without understanding the history of Livingstone's journeys. But of course, I understand that for Americans in particular, who had no colonial history with the continent of Africa, he might be a person that many do not know about.
And of course, he was sort of a combination missionary, explorer. He was driven by finding the source of the Nile.
That's right. He was one of the five or so men who were racing to find the source of the Nile. And I have to say, Rich, he was a spectacularly unsuccessful explorer. He expected to find the source of the Nile somewhere in Zambia, where it's further northeast, you know. And he was also a very unsuccessful missionary because he only managed to convert one person who then changed his mind. So he's in the tradition of great British heroic failures, you know.
And yet he must have inspired some loyalty in his attendants and the people surrounding him that they would embark in this amazing journey.
Absolutely. That's a really great observation. And in fact, I would say that it's in his relationship with not only his African companions, but with other Africans in the areas that he traveled. I think that's where he was most successful. And that's where we really saw his humanity. He was greatly opposed to the slave trade, for instance, even though, again, there's some complication there because he was also rescued quite a few times by slave traders who ended up supplying him with resources that he needed for his journey and so on. So he was a really complicated man. And I was drawn to write about the companions, partly because I also wanted to show his character and how he related to his African companions.
Of course, for Americans, when we hear slavery, we think of the Middle Passage from the west coast of Africa to the Indies and America. But of course, there was another thriving slave trade on the east coast of Africa.
No, indeed. And that's another reason that I really wanted to write about this, because I don't think many people know that there was an equally thriving slave trade on the east coast of Africa, where slaves would be taken from the interior and from up and down the coast of Africa, and would be traded and sent off to India, as far as India and as far as Persia. But of course, a lot of the slaves, you know, simply traveled up and down the coast and were sent to the island of Zanzibar, which had the largest slave market at the time.
So Livingstone spent many years in the heart of Africa. And again, as you allude to earlier, you know, the dark side of Livingstone is he basically opened up Africa to colonialism by the European powers. And I think your title sort of alludes to that, out of darkness, that idea that this interior of Africa was unknown. It was dark. Nobody knew anything about this place.
No, indeed. And in fact, there's a poem that we used to do when I was 11 years old. I still remember some of the words. It goes something like, "Do you remember Livingstone? Dr. David Livingstone. He went to darkest Africa. We knew that she had edges, just like a field has hedges, but Livingstone found that she had a middle." So there was this, you know, right up to the 1980s when I was in school, this idea of the dark continent into which Livingstone shone the light, you know. And I wanted to reverse that idea a little bit and say, actually, no, it was his companions who, by bringing out Livingstone, actually shone that light. Because, of course, unintentionally, they also carried out his the maps of what, you know, the men of his ages called his last great discoveries. And one of those last great discoveries was that the Lualaba River is connected to the Congo, which became the navigable river down which colonialism would come. So you're absolutely right to say that he did not himself intend colonization of Africa, but he was actually the precursor to colonization.
You write that this took nearly 20 years to write this novel. Why did it take so long?
Partly because I really didn't trust myself as a writer. I famously suffer from imposter syndrome. And no, really, I do. I didn't trust myself as a writer, but also I just didn't think I had enough knowledge about the era, about the time, even just about how expedition life actually works. So I had this amazing idea for a novel in my mind, but I didn't really understand the mechanics, even just the mechanics of how they traveled from place to place. So I spent about, you know, 20 years or so just researching the background to all of this.
I understand you became somewhat of a Livingstone collector.
Oh, yes. I have my very own personal Livingstonia, as I call it. I have all these first editions of his diaries and his journals. I have first edition of How I Found Livingstone by Stanley. I have newspapers from the era showing his famous funeral at Westminster Abbey. He was actually the first non-royal to get a state funeral at Westminster Abbey. So I have all this material that I've just collected.
Well, you tell the story through two actual people that are mentioned, I believe, in Livingstone's journals, as well as a new journal by one of your characters that has actually been published this year.
That's right.
Halima is a cook and attendant, and she's mentioned a few times in the journals. And Jacob Wainwright, who was an attendant and translator for him, I think, he was actually from the East African Yao people, and he was, I think, given this name at some point in his life when he was rescued by anti-slavers, and he ends up with a Livingstone. So how did you settle on these two characters?
That's such a great question, because I initially started off with about 14 voices. I wanted to mimic Faulkner, William Faulkner, as I lay dying. You know, that famous novel that is told in multiple voices about a funeral wake. So I wrote this novel initially in 14 voices. And then I realized that I really couldn't keep track of all of the voices, and some of them sounded very much like the other, you know. So I zoomed in on these two voices because I wanted this contrasting narrative. So Halima, as you rightly say, is mentioned in David Livingstone's own journals, and he says of her, she's a good soul, but my goodness, she has an outrageous tongue. And Stanley also makes the same observation, that we could hear the sound of a furious gossip. You know, so I got this impression of this Halima as being a very chatty person, and I am a chatterbox myself. So I gave her that quality, and I made a really, you know, she's afraid of no one, but at the same time, she's a slave, or she thinks she's a slave. So she's actually, in theory, she's enslaved, but she's actually the most free person in the book, because she casts her, you know, sarcastic eye on everybody, you know. And in contrast is Jacob Wainwright. As you say, he's a rescued slave, and he has been Christianized, and he wants to save Africa, he wants to end the slave trade, he has all these lofty ambitions. But he's actually the most imprisoned and most enslaved person in the book, because he's so rigid in his thinking.
He's almost like he's already been colonized.
Exactly, that's exactly it. He's one of the first people to be colonized, even before colonization.
Well, I have to admit, I loved Halima, her voice, and I can understand why you chose this character, because just from that description, and I think you used that as a heading for one of the chapters, I mean, this gives a novelist wonderful license to create a character.
Thank you so much. I was so happy when I found out that you know, these expeditions also had women, because that's something new that I didn't know at all. I thought it was just parties of men. But they actually had women in the parties. You know, they had road wives, as they were called, and sometimes the wives had children. So it was a fairly festive, gathering. You know, there would be men, there would be their women, there would be their children. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that they moved very slowly. Jacob Wainwright complains at one point that, oh, you know, the problem with expedition life is all these women. You know, they slow things down.
And this gets the whole story about how little there is written about this journey of taking Livingstone's body back to England from the middle of Africa. You know, I could find nothing on this. And the only two people named are characters in your book, but fairly, you know, they're not major characters, and that is Chuma and Susi.
Yeah, these are the Chuma and Susi are the only people who are mentioned, because they are the only two people, well, apart from Jacob Wainwright, but he proved to be a disappointment when he came to England. But Chuma and Susi actually were brought to England, and they were paraded around, and they were shown as, you know, his most faithful companions. And that's why we still have, you know, we still have them as part of the history. And in fact, they narrated the last part of Livingstone's last journal. And that's how we know as much as we do about the journey, because they gave a first-hand account. But it's a very sort of strange account, because they don't really go into any detail as to what happened. And in those silences is where I found my story, because I was able to invent this journey completely anew. And as you said earlier, you know, Jacob Wainwright actually wrote a journal as they were walking, as they were marching. But it's only just been discovered, and it was actually discovered just before we went to print, so I haven't had a chance to read it.
Ah, well, I mean, it was just printed within the last few months, so I think you'll be looking at figuring out how closely your created journal matches up with the true article.
Oh, I think it's probably only it matches up in terms of the places that they visited. But in terms of all the, you know, horrible things that happened, I probably think, you know, those came straight out of my mind, I think, yeah.
My guest today is Patina Gapa. She is a Zimbabwe writer and international trade lawyer. Her second novel is titled Out of Darkness, Shining Light. It is published by Simon & Schuster. It's an account from the attendants of David Livingstone of this remarkable journey that these attendants took to bring his body 1,000 miles from what is now present-day Zambia to what is now the Tanzanian coast and Zanzibar to bring his body back to England, this amazing explorer, and this amazing journey by these people who most people would just bury his body. And in fact, there was a big debate about this, wasn't there?
So there was a big debate about what to do with his body. And this is an actual debate that I looked into. And this is because a lot of the men in the party were Muslim. And of course, you know, in the Islamic tradition, you bury a person almost the day that they die. The burials are very quick. But then they decided instead to take this extraordinary journey. And what I really enjoyed writing the parts where they prepare the body for travel. And there I really unleashed my inner Stephen King, you know, because they did some pretty extraordinary things to the body. So they had to eviscerate him and take out all these insides. And in the Victorian tradition, you know, they spoke very romantically that they buried his heart in Africa, you know. But of course they had to bury his heart and his lungs and his spleen and his liver because they couldn't dry out those parts. So the parts that they couldn't dry out, they buried, and then they dried the rest of his body and made him effectively rich into Livingstone jerky. isn't that wonderful? So they basically dried his body for 2 weeks, and then they folded him in half and disguised him as a package for trade. Because, of course, you know, this is pre-colonial Africa, lots of superstition in the villages, so they couldn't exactly go around telling people, we have a dead body, can we please spend the night, you know?
So help inform me about the traditions of burial in this part of Africa. I mean, I would think there would be some huge taboos about just making the journey in the first place.
Not only making the journey in the first place, but just, you know, moving around with a dead body, because, you know, as with most superstitious people, death is associated with witchcraft. You know, no one just dies, you know. You only die because somebody has bewitched you. And, you know, so for instance, I mean, up to these days, people still believe that there's, you know, some people, not a lot of people, but some people believe that there's witchcraft to every death. So if somebody dies of cancer, the question is, well, who bewitched him so that he got cancer, you know? So you can imagine that in those days where the superstitions were even stronger, it would have been a terrible taboo to, you know, sort of like traipse from village to village, carrying not only a body, but the dead body of a white stranger, you know?
Mm-hmm. One of the things I found interesting in your novel is how the uniqueness of who he was sort of a calling card for Livingstone wherever he went. He was white. And I think you quote a sing-song that you created in which, this is David Livingstone, he has different hair than us.
Yes. And in fact, Livingstone, yes. Let me see if I can try and sing that song. Tam tam vengirese, nena sisu ya konda, but tam tam vengirese, nena sisu ya konda. And in fact, that's actually the song that they sang at the sort of the service to mark his death in Chitambo, in a village in Zambia. And the hair thing was really just extraordinary. And Livingstone talks about how people reacted to his hair quite a few times. And there's a time when he was bathing in the river and he had, you know, soaked his hair to wash it. And everybody believed that his brains were coming out of his head.
Well, what did you learn about this journey itself? You know, it's close to 1,000 miles from where he died in Zambia, present day, to Tanzania. Was it difficult to find out what route they took, how they went? How did you find this story?
Well, I mean, the route wasn't that difficult to trace out because, as I said, Chuma and Susi, who were brought to England some months after Livingstone was buried, actually traced out the route for the people who were preparing his final journal. So that wasn't that difficult. What was difficult was to find the modern names for some of the places through which they traveled, because, of course, the map of Africa has changed significantly since then. Now they basically walked through two modern African nations, Tanzania and Zambia. And what I found really intriguing about the journey, Rich, is, you know, just to discover just how many people were in it. Because as I said before, initially I thought it was just Susi and Chuma and maybe Jacob Wainwright, but having discovered that there were 69 people and some of them were women, some of them were children, to me that was really mind-blowing because I began to understand that, you know, these explorers basically moved around in really groups that were as big as villages.
Right, I would think so. I mean, you know, let's face it, Europeans are not going to carry all the baggage. They're not going to do all...
They're not going to carry the baggage themselves. And also they traveled with some pretty extraordinary things, like Stanley, you know, Henry Morton Stanley, when he came out to Ujiji to look for Livingstone, he traveled with a bathtub.
Well, you know, you were talking about this journey, and I was really struck as I was doing research on this that, you know, there was a look at a map that showed two maps of this part of Africa from 1870 to 1913. And in 1870, you see all these small kingdoms, all, you know, looking even, you know, more different groupings than you'd see in modern day Africa with its countries. And then by 1913, it's just these huge swaths of colonial rule.
Absolutely. And it's all covered in red. It's all part of the British Empire. And it's incredible how quickly that took place. There's a map, Rich, that you should look for. It's called the Map of African Literature. It really is the most extraordinary thing. I thought Map of African Literature, my goodness, they're talking about Chinua Achebe and Olesho Inca and whatnot. But actually, it's the map of the Europeans who wrote Africa into existence. Isn't it something? So on the Map of African Literature, Livingstone is written across most of Central Africa. And then we have Burton in East Africa. We have, you know, Mungo Park in West Africa. We have Stanley all over the Belgian Congo. You know, it's really quite this idea that a place could be written into being and completely ignoring the actual people who lived there, you know, the city-states, the kingdoms, even the empires.
Yes, well, we have that issue in the United States as well. You know, the idea that Livingstone discovered Victoria Falls to our Western European explorers that discovered various places and, of course, the indigenous people. Well, you know, they knew about it for, you know, generations and upon generations.
Yeah. You know, to be fair to Livingstone, he never actually claimed to have discovered anything. And he always wrote very curiously in his journals. He would say, oh, the locals call this Shongwe or Mosiwoya Tunya. I am going to call it Victoria Falls. So, I mean, there was that sort of arrogance to, you know, renaming places. But to be fair to him, he never at one point said, I have discovered the Victoria Falls. But though, of course, that's how he was talked of. You know, people talked of him as the discoverer of this and the discoverer of that.
Well, let's talk a little about the two characters that you chose, Halima the cook, the sharp-tongued cook, who has this dream of a house that Livingstone has promised her freedom in her mind and a house of her own. This is one of her motivating forces.
Yes, and actually that's something that I took again directly from Livingstone's journals, where he talks about, you know, what a good soul Halima is and how she makes him these damper cakes that are good for his teeth because his teeth had fallen out. And then he says, when we get to Zanzibar, I shall free her and buy her a house with a garden, which I thought was just a lovely thing. And it really, to me, showed the relationship that was there between them. And so I make that a motivating factor for her. She's a woman who's been bought by Livingstone because one of his men has taken a fancy to her. So in reality, she is Livingstone's slave, right? And he actually says, I'm going to free her and buy her a house and a garden. So these are the two things that motivate her freedom and this idea of a house and a garden of her own.
Of course, that flies in the face of the fact that we consider Livingstone an abolitionist.
Man, Rich, because, you know, he was an abolitionist in the sense that he absolutely abhorred the slave trade, and he wrote very movingly against it. And in fact, there was an eyewitness account he wrote of a massacre in a market in Manyema country, which so outraged people that when the witness account was published after his death, it actually forced the British to put pressure on the Sultan of Zanzibar, and that's how the Zanzibar market was ended. So yes, there was this very strong feeling that he had as a Christian and as a human against the slave trade. But at the same time, he also benefited greatly from the assistance of slave traders. On two occasions at least, he was lost and he had no provisions. And it was those slave traders that helped him find his way to the coast.
Of course, his attendants or slaves were the people that made his travels possible in the first place.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, Halima is a bit of an aberration because he bought her in order to free her from this Arab merchant who was her master. But the pagazi that he traveled with, and the pagazi are the porters who carry these things, they were actually paid. I mean, they were paid porters. Mm. You know, they were actually paid porters. So they were not all of them slaves, you know. He would occasionally, like, you know, when they came across slave parties, he would occasionally buy somebody in order to free them, especially the very young. Like, he rescued at least two young boys who were, you know, traveling with the slaving party. But he himself didn't really have slaves in the sense of people that worked for him without being paid.
Hmm. Tell us about this other character, Jacob Wainwright. Again, we talked earlier about how he's almost has a colonialized mentality already, even though colonialism hasn't come to this part of Africa. He believes in the European ways completely. And what does this journey do to him?
Well, on the journey itself, he's very much the sort of like stayed and, you know, he tries to be this upright Christian. He's really drunk the Kool-Aid of Christianity. He really believes that Christianity is what's going to save him and what's going to save Africa. But as he now, you know, leaves Africa and he now goes into the heart of England, where when he goes to the funeral, to David Livingstone's funeral, then we see a transformation. And I'm not going to tell you what happens to him. But he then comes to confront the reality of what Christianity actually means to him. And basically, it puts him in an inferior position. And that journey, that realization, is a very important step in what I hope will ultimately be his emancipation.
In real life, Jacob Wainwright did live in England for a while. I think he was a schoolmaster, failed at that, and eventually returned to Africa.
Yes, he did indeed. He lived in England for a while, and he tried to be ordained, but he apparently made a very bad impression. And people considered him very arrogant and very cocky. Because, you know, when you've tutored somebody in a new religion and they seem to be better at it than you are, it's not exactly going to endear. So he didn't really endear himself to many people. And then in real life, he had a very tragic end. But I stopped the novel before we get to the tragic end of Jacob Wainwright because I wanted him at the end of a novel to be sort of, if not happy, then enlightened and at least alive.
Now, in the novel, you use you create his journal. What was your reaction when you found out that, Wainwright's actual diary has been found, it's digitized, and is going to be published? What was your reaction?
I was thrilled. I was so thrilled, Rich, because I want the story of these companions to be told, and I want them to be told as many different times as Livingstone's own story has been told. You know, there's a fantastic Zambian writer called Nangwali Sepal. I don't know if you've read her book called The Old Drift. So I heard that she had actually started the first chapter of her novel with the Livingstone story, and I was extremely excited to read her take on it. I have to say that initially, when I was first seized with the idea of the novel, I was very worried that somebody else might steal the idea from me. And then I realized the best ideas are meant to be stolen. And in fact, the more we have people writing about these characters, the better it is. So the fact that they've actually found excerpts of Jacob Wainwright's diary, to me, is just the most wonderful thing. So I'm hoping to go to Scotland in November to have a look at it because it's in the David Livingstone Memorial Museum, which is located in David Livingstone's old home.
And I think what you're trying to get at is, you know, so many of Africa's stories has been told from the perspective of white Europeans. This is a story that can, an African story by Africans, done by Africans, created by Africans, and accomplished by Africans that need to be told and publicized.
That's exactly it. We have had so many years of David Livingstone being center stage, Stanley being center stage, all the explorers being center stage. So anything that gets us talking and thinking about the Africans that helped them on these journeys, that made these journeys possible, I think that's such a good thing to happen.
Zimbabwean writer Patina Gappa speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her latest novel is titled Out of Darkness, Shining Light. It's published by Scribner. By the way, we apologize for the quality of the phone line on this interview. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.